What?
There's no number three on my TV. It skips to two and one and to zero. It will go off quickly.
How about if I come back in a minute and I fix your TV?
No, that will take forever.
That
It
will
will
take a minute.
one minute.
Okay, you go wait and I'll be back.
It's on.
And you need to go to bed.
The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, the Man of Steel on the auction block, the Commander-in-Chief taking over the industry, Wee Huey overstepping his bounds, plus Deadshot's in your house shooting up your targets, Icon has Silk Spectre, Kiana has invisible space blasters, and Stephen Ignatius Francis Schleicher is a rotten old something-something and all sorts of mean, nasty stuff with the 25 8x10 colored glossy photographs with the circles and arrows and the paragraphs on the back describing each one, so when the chorus comes around, everybody sing together with feeling.
You can get anything you want at a Matthew's restaurant.
Except in Matthew, the Major Spoilers podcast is on the air.
Welcome, welcome everybody to another exciting week of Major Spoileries. Spoileries?
I understand less and less references out of the open with every passing
show. All right,
show.
So let's go through it. First thing that Matthew mentioned was that maybe we should start backwards. The last
right.
thing, though, with the diagrams and all of that is Alice's Restaurant.
Right, Alice's Restaurant, right. That seminal folk song by Arlo Guthrie.
That a radio station in Kansas City plays
every
Thanksgiving, and it's
this
a big
is
deal.
A story
and it
about
takes
Alice
up all of Thanksgiving.
And
it's a 20-minute song, yeah. It's a great.
But the restaurant ain't called Alice's Restaurant. That's just the name of the song, and that's why the song is called Alice's Restaurant.
And I wonder how many times Bruce Otter had to listen to that when he was rooming with you.
Not nearly as much as you think,
oh, right.
actually.
Okay.
I think he may have introduced me to that song, but previous to that,
and
of course.
I've regretted it ever since.
Icon has Silk Spectre is a reference to the Lolcats and to the fact that we'll be talking about the Watchmen later on
Watchmen.
In the show.
Chiana having invisible space blasters, another Lolcats reference, and a reference to Rodrigo's review this week.
Okay.
Deadshot in your house shooting up your targets, of course, a third Lolcats reference, because humor comes best in threes,
right?
Rodrigo, Matthew, and Steven.
Exactly.
The
or as we like to call them, the fat one, the bald one, and the one who no longer has a beard.
Well, I was bald before the haircut today, so. And the first one that kicked it off, Superman up on the auction block, is talking about Action Comics number one. It's an
unrestored.
Now, this means that it's not been touched up. It's not had a little paint daubing
Correct.
Here or there. It's not been ironed out to get the cracks out of it. No
Exactly.
new staples have been put in. The edges
Right.
haven't been cut and trimmed so that it's all nice and neat. This is a copy
Exactly.
that some kid bought in, like, the 1950s for, like, 35 cents.
Right.
It was a 10 cent. He bought it for 35 cents some year later, put it down in his basement, and forgot about it until a couple of years ago, a year or so ago.
Nice.
So it's just been sitting there. It's
yeah.
been graded at a 6.0,
right?
And it's currently up for auction, and it's got, I think, probably by the time most of these people listen to this, hello, future
yeah.
people, I think it's probably only got a few days left in the auction. But at the
yeah.
time that we're recording this, the bidding had been up to something like $275,000.
Wow.
We're looking at almost 300 large. And something that's important to keep in mind about a 3.0, or excuse me, a 6.0 comic.
Yes.
6.0 comic is, I've seen comics less than 10 years old that aren't a 6.0. A 6.0 is about the average for comics that I'm seeing from the 50s, 60s, 70s, Bronze Age Marvel books. That means the cover has to still be attached.
Yep.
There can be some tattering. There can be a little bit of folding or some creasing. I believe a 6.0 still has to have a relatively pleasant, I don't know if you're familiar
odor.
With the really, yeah, the strong odor that you get on a decomposing comic.
Yeah.
Your pages can be brown, but I believe they're cream to tan,
mm-hmm.
which means they're not that ugly brown color. I have Ghost Rider comics from 1978, 89 in that era that aren't a 6.0 anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, a 72, 73-year-old comic to be a 6.0 is pretty phenomenal, especially this particular issue, well, one of the rarest remaining.
Well, yeah, because there's only 100 of these remaining in existence. And yeah. Of those, 80% or 80, it makes the math real easy when there's only 100 known in existence, 80% of those have been restored.
Right.
So the unrestored, the untouched, the unvarnished truth is a pretty
theoretically,
rare. Theoretically, could go for $1 million.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you figure 20% of them are unrestored. That's 2 out of 10, or almost half. And Math and I are old enemies, by the way. But a 6.0 of anything of that vintage. I know I own a comic from 1941 that's maybe a 5.5.
Wow.
I don't even care what's in it. I've never opened it. I've never read it because it's a golden age comic in good condition. And, you know, being a geek, I own it because I can now say I own a golden age comic in mint – or not mint, but –
in good condition.
Decent condition.
Yeah, I was...
A book that's older than my mother, who passed away 2 or 3 years ago. But, I mean, just owning a book, even if it's, you know, in my case, Atomic Thunderbolt number 1. You ever heard of the Atomic Thunderbolt?
Nope.
Me neither. But I own it.
Nice.
I saw a Doc Savage. I saw one of the pulp Doc Savage books, one of the original magazines, in terrible condition. This thing was, like, ripped, and it was nasty looking. And it probably was a 3 or a 4, but the guy was still wanting almost $500 for it because it's so rare. So the question is, maybe to you, Rodrigo, since Matthew and I have kind of talked on, and we want to get you into this show a little bit.
Like Rodrigo has nothing to do
with it. How much would you be willing to pay for
Action
Comics
now?
Number 1? And again, and Life's a Glitch pointed this out. Well, Steven, you can't say money is no object. Yeah, you can say money is no object. Because if I asked Rodrigo, how much would you be willing to pay? And he goes, well, I only make $35,000 a year or whatever that you make. I'm sure you make more than that, $80,000, $90,000 a year.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, you're making this much money a year. You might be going, hey, you know, $100,000 may not be a big deal. But, you know, if you're in a fixed income, you might say, hey, $2,000 is a lot for a comic. How much would you be willing?
My income, because it's broken.
I'm paying you all the Luthor dollars you want, man. What do you want?
The problem is they only spend on Earth 42, and I never get there.
How much would you be willing to spend, Rodrigo?
I'm not any kind of collector at all. Honestly, if I was going to try to buy Action Comics number 1 or whatever, I would buy it to try to sell it later.
Mm-hmm.
So
well,
I
that's
would,
a good answer.
I guess the answer is 20% of what I want to sell it for is what I would pay for it.
All right, there you go. That's a good answer. Would you pay $1 million for it if you knew you're going to get $1,200,000 later on?
I don't think anybody would give me a loan for that much money.
But if money were no object.
Oh. Well, if money were no object, then I wouldn't need to sell it, so I wouldn't buy it at all.
All right. You know, even if I had all the money in the world, let's give me an imaginary number. This is the amount of money I want to win in the lottery. Let's say I've won $200 million in the lottery.
Congratulations.
Okay. Thank you very much, Matthew Rodrigo. I've got a new job for you guys. It's a full-time job, pays 6 figures a year. All you have to do is work on this silly comic book site.
Awesome.
That would be the first phone call after winning $200 million. Second phone call.
Can I have a new laptop?
You may, in fact. I will give you a fancy laptop. The next thing people would say is, hey, you've got all this money, Steven. Would you want to buy Action Comics number 1? And again, I got $200 million. There's no way I could spend that much money in the remainder of my lifetime, which is probably going to be about 6 months at the way I eat and don't exercise.
Right.
But
especially now that you can have
all the
people,
terrible food you can afford with $200 million.
I know, exactly.
You can get one of those deep-fried cheeseburgers made of a donut.
Oh, yeah, those are so good. But somebody would say, Steven, you could afford $1 million for a comic book. And I'd probably say, yeah, I could, but I think that's too much for a comic book. $250,000, yeah, I'd probably pay that much for a comic book. But when you start getting up to 1/200th of my entire wealth, and it's just a little piece of paper that I can freely get off sites like Scans. Oh, no, I can't.
Oh, let's not get into that.
Hello!
Or that I can find in reprints.
Right.
Well, then no, I'm not that interested in it. Matthew?
I have to agree with Rodrigo in that once you break about four figures, and I have a personal goal to never pay more than $100 for a comic book.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping for too.
But once you break four figures, it's no longer about the book. It's about speculation. It's about an investment. It's about, you know, granted, this is bad for me because I once bought a car for $75. But if you're paying more for a comic book than you paid for your car, you're not in it for the love of the comic book. You're in it for what can I get out of this? What is the tangible benefit?
Right.
What is the value of that comic as opposed to its actual price?
Because let's face it. Anyone who buys this, whoever wins this, is not going to read it. It's going under glass.
No. I'd knock it down to a 5.5.
It's going under glass, and there it will sit until the person decides they need money to finance a crappy movie, and so he decides to sell his entire Superman collection. I'm sorry, Nick Cage, but that's the truth. Speaking of speculation marketing there, Matthew Peterson, a lot of people are lining up for anything Barack Obama on comic books, and Barack is showing up, it seems like, on every frickin' comic book that comes out these days.
Not just on, but in every frickin' comic book. I don't know if you read Thunderbolts, but he's in Thunderbolts,
man.
And he appeared in Secret Warriors number one in Shadow, it wasn't really him, according to Marvel. But yeah, I mean, seriously, I'm just waiting for Richie Rich and Barack Obama.
now we know who's going to buy Action Comics number one.
Yeah. Exactly. Richie Rich is going to come out and he's going to fix the deficit crisis by, you know, I don't know, melting dollar down for
scrap.
But Barack Obama is selling comic books. Now, again, Barack Obama is selling comic books in the words of Dion, my employer at the comic book store, because dumbasses think they're going to be worth money.
Well, that's the question. Is it going to be worth money someday?
No.
Well, no.
Yeah.
What if the sad truth about most comic books being printed right now today?
But what if they're just buying it for a piece of history? First black president.
That's fine.
Yeah, that's fine.
And he meets Spider-Man.
Sure.
That would be fine.
And he endorses Norman Osborn.
You know what? You'd probably be better off, like, if you're like, okay, I'll buy Spectacular Barack Obama featuring Spider-Man number one.
Yes.
So that I can have that one, the one where the X-Men meet Jimmy Carter, the one where Nixon Superman. And Captain America are hanging out.
And no, Nixon kills himself on panel in Captain
America.
Yeah,
that's the one.
176.
Superman
right.
and JFK and Superman. Yeah,
Ronald Reagan actually turns into a serpent creature and fights Captain America in Captain America 344.
Right.
From 1987.
So I would say, and especially considering that the Spider-Man one is actually the chameleon, like impersonating Barack Obama.
It's not really
like,
Barack.
There's a long, great tradition, especially in Marvel, of the president being some kind of horrible monster.
Or well, you know what this feels
alien
like to me?
Monster. So you should go out and find all of those and then build
and then
a collection
have a presidential
out of it.
Collection.
And the completeness of that particular presidential collection will amp up the value of Incredible Barack Obama number one featuring Spider-Man.
What about Barack Obama punching out Osama bin Laden?
That's too much.
Okay.
That's on an issue of Savage Dragon. It won't sell. I'm sorry. Savage Dragon is, and you know, forgive me for saying this, and I don't mean any
disrespect
insult
to
the
Eric
creators
Larson.
Involved. Savage Dragon is, and has been for several years, essentially a vanity press piece. It is printed because Eric Larson loves doing it. Were Eric Larson not the publisher of Image, I don't know that you would continue seeing Savage Dragon. It's one of those books that I've read it off and on for years. You know, I'm not proud of having a collection of Savage Dragon books, but Savage Dragon exists because Eric Larson loves comic books and wants to write one.
Good. I say more power to him.
Oh, yeah, sure.
What about Barack Obama on the cover of Youngblood, drawn by Rob Liefeld? Granted, you don't see the president's ankles, but...
Well, the president doesn't have any ankles and his head is enormous. That one feels kind of – and this is weird to say when we're talking about the commander-in-chief appearing on a comic book. It feels a little speculative. But the thing about it that kind of strikes me, and I'll freely admit I overanalyze everything to the point of ridiculousness.
No, that's fine. Please do.
What this kind of feels like is, generally speaking – and again, there are exceptions, but generally speaking, most of the creators involved in comics seem to have a pretty liberal bent. True. And we have spent, you know, what, 8 years under a more conservative sort of, I don't want to say regime, a more conservative group
administration
of leaders. We've had a conservative leadership for about 8 years. And as with anything that you do for about 8 years, at the end of 8 years, you're like, well, maybe it's time for a little change. Mm-hmm. So the comic book people, to me, seeming to be a little more liberal leaning, are going, hey, yeah, this is a liberal guy. This is going to be our guy, and we're going to make change, and it's going to be awesome. Whether that's true or not is still up for speculation. Yeah. I know, you know, I'm not going to tell you who I voted for, but I'm not entirely unhappy with seeing the Commander-in-Chief all over comics. Keep in mind, I believe that the Savage Dragon a couple of years ago had an issue where the dragon was on the cover punching out George W. Bush.
Probably.
So maybe Savage Dragon is giving us some overt commentary rather than the covert. Yeah. But what you going to do?
Poor DC. Hey. You know, all these Barack covers are selling like hotcakes, and DC has made a point to never include the real world in their comics, yeah, except when it suits them. And so they've got to be, you know, wringing their hands going, how can we get this money?
Trinity's an alternate universe. Stick him in there.
There you go.
Hey!
Do you guys care about Suicide Squad, the movie?
You damn right I care about Suicide Squad, the movie.
Who's going to play Amanda Waller?
CCH Pounder.
I think that's what everybody said that. And I was like, you know what? That actually would probably work.
Isn't she the one that does the voice for Amanda Waller?
Yeah. You know who I want to see as Deadshot?
Who?
Steve Buscemi.
Ooh. Just because
Buscemi
of his
with a greasy little mustache and wrist blasters.
Just because of his appearance in Happy Gilmore?
No, because where Steve Buscemi and Deadshot are essentially the same character.
Where he takes out the bad guy at the end of Happy Gilmore.
Go back and read Secret Six number one.
Okay.
And that moment where Deadshot beats up the criminal, takes his gun, and robs the store for him to show him how to do it right, yeah, and then keeps the money.
Yeah. Yep.
And the cigarettes.
Yeah.
That, imagine that coming out of the mouth of Steve Buscemi.
Yep.
In his full-out Fargo mode.
But here's the question.
That'll sell some comics.
Here's a movie about a bunch of villains that nobody outside of comic books really knows. Captain Boomerang, Deadshot. Who else is the main people that we know from that series?
The original lineup was Captain Boomerang, Deadshot, Nightshade, Nemesis.
Exactly.
Flag, okay. The Enchantress.
Okay, a bunch of nobodies, you know, a bunch of C-listers as far as the rest of the world is concerned. Why would they care about seeing this villain's forced to go do these things for this government agency? Granted, it's a great idea. Don't get me wrong. I want to see it, but...
That's why people would be interested in seeing this, because they'll see, here's something that we haven't seen in a movie. It's a bunch of supervillains doing this stuff, and they won't necessarily know that they're supervillains from a comic book.
Well, here's the thing. You know, Suicide Squad.
As long as Wonder Woman never shows up to beat them up, it's okay.
Well, see, that could be the problem. Problem is, number one, where's the Justice League movie before this one gets made, which is somewhat troubling from a movie standpoint. Well, because, I mean, you'd think that if you're a company trying to hype and build up on your arsenal or your pantheon of titles that you have, I would think JLA or even JSA would rank higher than Suicide Squad in terms of how can we make money off of this. The problem is, if Suicide Squad tanks and people realize that it's a comic book movie, they're going to say, well, all comic book movies are like this. This marks the death knell of all comic book movies. Therefore, we're going to stop going to see comic book movies, yada, 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 yada.
They haven't yet. And
no, they
and
haven't.
People went to see Daredevil.
They have
and
not.
And there are some pretty terrible ones. And Elektra.
Yeah.
But
well, let me
finish my thought here that I had a moment ago. Suicide Squad is nothing. Suicide Squad is nothing more than the Dirty Dozen, or this. What's the one with
Ocean's 11?
No, not Ocean's 11. The guy that's in Ocean's 11, but the Dirty Bastards or whatever this movie coming out with him in it.
Old Dirty Bastard.
Old Dirty Bastard. Live in concert. No. I'm talking about the Inglorious Bastards. The Inglorious Bastards. Okay. You know, it's like that. Here are a bunch of POWs being forced to do something for the greater good. Mm-hmm. And so Suicide Squad, if you think of it in terms of the Dirty Dozen, one of the best movies ever made, the one with Telly Savalas, man, that does sound like a good movie.
Yeah.
Rodrigo, finish what you were going to say.
All right.
And we'll flip side it over to Matthew.
What was Marvel's first like successful movie, like the first successful movie with a Marvel character.
Defined to success, I suppose, but most people would probably say in the modern era, Spider-Man.
Wrong. Blade.
And did anybody, there you go. That's
and
true.
Did anybody know that Blade was a Marvel property? No. This is how Marvel tried it out. They were like, okay, let's try a superhero movie, but let's throw out a character that we actually don't care that much about.
Yeah.
Let's try it.
Flops,
let's do it and
if
see
it flops,
if it works.
Then it's no big deal.
This could be the prototype for the team movie that eventually becomes the JLA.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I agree with you there. Matthew?
That's deep, Ogre. I think you're looking at it from a deductive rather than an inductive perspective. Take it from this way. If you really want to make money, like Rodrigo said, do you start by throwing your best stuff on the screen and going, here's the Justice League of America, but we couldn't get Brandon Routh and we couldn't get Christian Bale, so we got Bobcat Goldthwait and Wally Cox.
Oh, man, that would be awesome.
Whereas the Suicide Squad, if you play Suicide Squad right, here's what you need. You need compelling characters. You need an Ocean's 11-style plot. You need about 45 seconds of flashback explaining. And you can do it like Oz, you know, prisoner number 957.
Well, again, you do it just like in Dirty Dozen.
Yeah, but only well. And I'm sorry, I'm thinking of another Dirty Dozen.
Yeah, yeah, no, we're not talking about the one with
Steve Martin. Oh, wait, no, that's Cheaper by the Dozen.
Right. I had Tom Welling in it before he became a Legionnaire, if I'm not mistaken. But I think that when you start with the Suicide Squad, or you start with Blade, or you start with, you know, something that is, yes, a property that could be successful, but not something that John Q. Public is going to go, this sure is a comic book movie, Ethel, we better not go. I think you're doing it from the perspective of you're building your audience. You're showing people what's possible. You're saying, here's where we can go with this. When you get to that Justice League movie, maybe you can actually have Nathan Fillion as Green Lantern. You know, you can actually have a cast that makes sense because you've learned how to do this by putting together the other movies. Now, with a Suicide Squad movie, the only thing that I'm going to have a problem with is, as with Wanted, they're going to want to redeem everybody at the end.
Hmm.
Suicide Squad, you got to kill some people. You got to kill them on panel. You got to kill them spec-freaking-tacular.
Who died in that first story run from that team that you listed off?
Mindboggler died. Nightshade was presumed dead. Nemesis was lost and later came back and is currently dating Wonder Woman, which proves that even a C-lister can get some if he's lucky. I think the major deaths were really minor characters. In fact, most of the deaths in Suicide Squad were minor characters. Black Adam did a run with the squad.
I kind of disagree about redeeming. I you know, even in the end of, again, Dirty Dozen or Ocean's 11, these people weren't redeeming themselves in any way. They were still terrible people. The True. Big difference is, and you may have seen already that Justice League Unlimited episode that had the Suicide Squad in it. It was called Task Force X.
That was a great one.
That was a good one, and it ended like, I
wow,
hope they
Captain
would.
Boomerang's pretty cool.
I would hope that they would end the movie like they did Task Force X episode, where it's like, okay, you said we could be done, and Amanda Waller's like, we didn't tell you when, how many missions you had to do, and so there it leaves it open for sequels. Do you think Hollywood would really do that, Matthew? Try to make it a happy ending where everybody parts on good terms and they're free?
Yep.
Well, look at the sad, horrible, horrible thing that was League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. You have, like, Dr. Jekyll, like, trying to swim up to the top of something while his reflection, Edward Hyde, is like, you can do it! We are best friends now! It is awesome! You are the guy! Apparently, Edward Hyde is also Strong Bad.
Yeah, apparently. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is a huge example of trying to, you know, jolly up a concept that should not be superhero-y because people seem to have an explanation of what they think a comic book movie should be. When we got to the Alan Quartermain mobile, I'm like, okay, I'm out.
Yep.
Okay.
I'm like Kramer 5 minutes after the girl across the street took off her top. I'm done.
All right. We're probably going to address this concern in a couple of weeks when we talk about the Watchmen movie and
Watchmen.
Adaptations in general. So
Watchmen
I'm sure
movie.
We will bring this back up at another date.
1, 2, 3, 4. Time for email.
Hello. I think that's what he's trying to say. Hello. I know this is a few weeks late.
That's my attempt to transition a little less awkwardly than we have.
Well, okay. Wait till we actually get to the end of the page here. Okay. I know this is a few weeks late. However, I wanted to let you fellas know that I will be attending WonderCon tomorrow, which was last weekend or last month. Future people.
Hello, past people.
Why is that so important? Well, because it's due to major spoilers, and for that I thank you. Your podcast has turned me from a closet geek to a full-fledged comic book nerd. I listen to your show every Wednesday on my way to get comics and really appreciate all the hard work you three put into each episode. The moment I guess.
Okay. There's a script for this?
What? The moment I knew I was a geek a few weeks ago, I immediately, after having searched for one since the figure came out last summer, bought the last Dark Knight Two-Face figure at my local Target and didn't open it.
Oh.
Thanks again. Keep up the great work, Thomas Ka. Or maybe that's Thomas in California. Maybe.
Right. And on behalf of all the other geeks, welcome to hell. Here's your accordion.
I guess, great. I'm glad we're turning more and more people over to the show.
To the dork side.
Welcome to dark the dork side.
Yes. I do have we need to really have a conversation at some point in the future. And I know we made this a poll at one point. Are you a geek, a nerd, a dork, spaz, dweeb, you know? There's actually a difference between a geek and a nerd. A geek is somebody that you see at the sideshows that pound nails into their head.
A geek is somebody that eats live
the heads
animals.
Off of chicken.
Yes, yes.
And a nerd is a creature that Dr. Seuss made up.
Yes, there you go. Hey, you
a
know, it was his birthday just the other day. So.
In the conventional nomenclature.
Okay, so there you go. As far as your Two-Face figure, great if you didn't open it. I had an entire closet full, and Rodrigo can attest to this.
Oh, yes.
I had an entire closet full packed. And this isn't a little tiny closet.
It's a room. He had
this is a small room that was filled from top to bottom, all the way back, with figures that I did not open. Mm-hmm. And it just took up too much room. And as we mentioned a moment ago with Barack Obama, these things are never going to be worth anything. Mm. Especially since what's-his-face didn't die. Aaron Eckhart is not dead. So the Two-Face character is going to be a little less...
Oh, really? They've said that...
Aaron Eckhart. No. Two-Face is dead in the movie.
Uh-huh.
The character Aaron Eckhart, like Heath Ledger, who is dead, is not dead. So his worth is not going to be...
Okay.
His worth is not going to be that much. I went ahead, and I spent... And I still haven't gotten through all the Simpsons figures yet. They are still scattered around a room. But I made it a point to just rip these things out of their package and enjoy them.
Yeah.
And I think you
Hello,
should too, Thomas.
My name is Homer Simpson. Hello, my name is Bart Simpson. We are going to play over here in the Springfield Elementary School. Okay, let's go.
I have a favorite
Don't
Homer.
Don't have a cow, man.
I have a
Cowabunga.
I have a favorite Homer Simpson quote whenever my son is crying now. There, boy. Shut up. And it seems to work. So thank you so much, Thomas Ka. For sending us this email. We always appreciate all the feedback, and hopefully you're going out and telling all your friends about the podcast. You know what? Record
Make
a bunch
your kids,
of these off.
Tell
record
the neighbors.
Record your favorite MP3s onto a CD and take about a dozen of them down to your comic book store next Wednesday when you go and just drop them in people's bags. Be covert about it.
Yeah.
And when they get home, they'll go, "What is this? A major spoilers. What? I shall put this in and listen to it." And pretty
soon, it must have a virus. I will break it.
And pretty soon we will take over the
AOL
world.
Is getting craftier and craftier. I am not installing this.
Page 2.
You know, I discovered today that I'm a ninja.
You are?
I walked up to a woman on my team. Now, I don't know if any of you have met me. But I am 6'2".
I was
going to
say, wait a minute, you're not a ninja.
And I'm like 377 pounds. So I don't expect to be a ninja. But I walked up to this woman and I put my finger on her shoulder to tell her that she needed to go into a certain code so we could coach her on something. And she screamed like a woman being chased by a sharky. So from now on, I'm going to be a ninja. Right now, you're not going to see me transitioning to a review.
I wish we had something like the Raising Arizona theme song that had the reviews.
Steven, how did we get to the review section?
I have no idea, Rodrigo.
I did not hear any sort of transition.
Our friends over at Boom Studios have been landing properties left and right.
They have, Boom. Man.
And they landed probably one of the most popular series on the Sci-Fi Channel after Stargate.
Mm-hmm.
Farscape.
Who?
And Eureka.
And Eureka, yeah. Of course, that's the founder of the company is right. The creator of Eureka. Right. But Farscape.
Yes.
And it launched a couple months ago, and they're up to issue number 3.
Mm-hmm.
And you picked it up and read it this week.
I did, and it was a mistake.
Aww.
And it's nothing to do with the issue, but as I'm reading it, I realize, well, this probably picks up right where Farscape has left off. I mean, the series has been off the air for a while, right?
Yeah, a couple of years.
Yeah. So, you know, it probably continues the adventures of these characters that I've seen. But I wasn't familiar with Farscape. I was actually kind of hoping that it would be kind of an entry-level thing to Farscape, and it isn't. It just continues what has probably become a very rich storyline. I have no idea who anybody is. The art is great,
mm-hmm.
but I have no idea what they're talking about.
Now, just out of curiosity, because you have access to issues 1 and 2. Did you read issues 1 and 2 as well?
I didn't.
Okay. So you're just dropping down and, hello, everybody, what's going on?
Yep, pretty much.
All right.
I know that the main character and the main male and female characters have a son, and that guy who looks like the gimp from
Pulp Fiction
has kidnapped him.
I believe his name is Scorpius, if I'm not mistaken.
Or Scorponok. Wait, no, that's a Transformer.
No, Scorponok was the giant Transformer that tried to kill Roadblock.
Right. You know, the art is fine. The art is actually really good. I mean, the art looks enough like the actors.
Yeah.
But not to the point where, you know, where you get that kind of, like, this is a shot that was clearly taken from, you know, the actor's, like, actual headshot.
Right.
Kind of thing.
Muppets are drawn really good.
The Muppets are drawn really well. The Gimp is drawn really well.
Pigs the ships, in space!
The ships have that kind of rounded look that all the ships in Farscape have. And,
right.
You know, that I like. Again, it's a very pretty show that I've never really seen with any regularity. Yeah.
Anytime
I flip it on, there's that bald girl, and there's that blue girl, and there's that thing, like, little Muppet monster, like, riding a flying scooter, and there's that bear guy with the really big nose.
So how was the writing, though? I mean, without understanding, I mean, was there a plot? Did it flow smoothly?
It has a plot, and it's pretty intense. I mean, it's funny to see these, like, really cute little Muppets having such, like, deep conversations. It's basically like this plot to, like, overthrow the current ruler of their planet, I think.
Yeah.
And they're all in prison, and they're all, like, essentially hatching a plan to escape, and they're all, like, pointing fingers at each other and saying, like, well, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you, kind of thing. So it's interesting, but unfortunately I have no idea what's going on.
Okay. So then how many slices of the old meatloaf will you give this one?
I'll give it 2.5 slices of meatloaf.
Okay. Now, if you were, do you think your mindset would have changed if you were more?
I think if I was into Farscape, I would probably be able to settle into this really well. I mean, I think part of the thing that probably makes it strong is the fact that it's just going. I mean, it's not settling. It's the fact that it's not explaining anything tells me that it's probably for Farscape fans.
Okay. All right. All right, so Farscape number 3 comes out this week, depending again when you're listening to this. Hello, future people.
Hello.
I'm also reviewing a new title that comes out this week. I'm also reviewing a title that comes out this week from Garth Ennis, Derek Robertson, The Boys, number 28 from Dynamite Entertainment.
The Boys.
Now, again, like Rodrigo, I have not really read The Boys since we did our trade paperback review of The Boys many issues ago. And if you're interested in what The Boys is all about, I highly encourage you to go back into the archives and listen to that. Because if you're wondering what a blarney cock is,
blarney cock,
then you need to go back and listen to that episode.
Yes.
The Boys.
So I have no idea what Wee Huey and the Butcher and all the other people are doing. But from what I've gathered from this issue, Wee Huey has gone undercover to infiltrate, I don't know what organization. Some organization that trains
the
superheroes.
G-Men.
Superhero frat.
Yes. And
the G-Men are run by a mysterious man named Godolkin, who is not bald in a wheelchair, but for all intents and purposes might as well be.
Right.
And so throughout the story, Wee Huey's undercoverness is being exposed, even though the Butcher has told him, you need to get the heck out of here. Don't be going to Silver Kincaid's funeral. Don't be making a scene. And for God's sake, don't let yourself be found out because people will kill you. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, the rest of Wee Huey's team finds out, and they take him out in the woods to kill him, or at least beat the answers out of him. But fortunately, the rest of the boys, the Frenchman and the girl, show up and literally decimate the rest of Wee Huey's team.
They kill 1/10 of them?
Yes, decimal.
So it's not a literal decimation, never mind.
No, it's a literal slaughter. To the point where the female...
Literally.
No, it's really...
Literally.
Takes
literally.
One of the heads that she's ripped off of one of the guys, throws it at one of the other guys that's running away, and smashes his head in with this thrown head. Nice. That's how cool it is.
I'm going to pick the little one up, and I'm going to kill the rest of you with him.
So then Shaft and Butcher show up, and...
Mother's milk.
I'm sorry. Again, I don't really read the series.
Damn
they show up,
right.
And they... they've kept one of the team alive to find out what's what, and the Butcher essentially tells this guy, look, if you don't give us the answers, I'm going to give this knife to Huey, and he's going to kill you. And so that's kind of where the issue leaves off. Again, not having read the boys in probably, what, 20 issues, you can jump into this and kind of get an idea of what's going on if you know the characters. If this is your first introduction to the boys, then no, you don't want to read this just yet. This is part 6, I think. Of We
part
Gotta Go Now,
seven.
Part 6 of 7, so there's one more to go. If you're looking to jump onto the series, I would probably wait until after the next issue. But this was an enjoyable read for people who pick things up occasionally. If you're wanting to check in and find out what's going on, I didn't really have a problem with it. Matthew, have you had a problem with this story arc right now? You've been reading every one.
I've been reviewing it for your website.
Yes, I know.
Too,
that's
Steve,
why I'm wanting to know what your overall reaction of the arc is.
I really actually enjoy this arc. This is really a change of pace for the team because they've been in a very reactive mode. This is the first time we see a really proactive strike. And Wee Huey going undercover has been hysterical.
Yeah.
Because I believe Huey is Scottish.
Right.
And the previous issue they spent at the St. Paddy's Day parade. And everybody was telling him how great it was to have a real Irish person at the parade. And he's like, I'm Scottish.
Yeah. And by the way, even though it's run by me and owned by me, it is our site.
Yes.
Oh, my bad.
So, you know,
I'm just saying that as the person who signs the Luthor dollars into the Luthor checks, you might Luthor read some of the stuff.
No,
that
I do.
Luthor
I do.
Writing.
But I wanted to see what your overall opinion of the arc was. Because, you know, you may have some favorable issues and less favorable issues. I'm giving this one 3.5 slices of dead superhero out of 5.
God, I hope it's not the Blob.
But as opposed to whom?
3.5 slices of the old meatloaf for the boys, number 28, out this week.
Word.
Matthew, let's dive into one of the big two.
One of the big two, or two of the big ones. Well, let's put it this way. It is a number two.
Oh, jeez.
I'm sorry. I believe this issue is about 10 days old because I've been running a little bit behind in my reviews. I picked up Justice League of America number 30, and it was a mistake.
Is this the Shadow Hunter one or whatever it is?
Sort of. In recent issues of Justice League, we've seen interactions which imply that the Shadow Cabinet and the characters from the Milestone comics have been apparently streamlined into New Earth. So the city of Dakota and the Shadow Cabinet characters apparently live on New Earth. New Earth. So the first thing that I notice about this issue, I opened to the very first panel of the very first page. Now, at this point in time, the Flash is incapacitated by a character called Twilight. All right?
Right.
And the first thing you see is Black Canary, Hawk Girl, Wonder Woman, and the Flash standing over a fallen Shadow Cabinet. So I'm like, okay, maybe the Flash got out. Somehow Twilight is a hero or a character who represents a portal to another dimension into which the Flash was sucked and had not come back. So I'm like, okay, the Flash came back. There's a lot of talkie-talkie where we find out that Hawkman is back. Old school Hawkman villain, the Shadow Thief.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
Is the man behind all of this fighty.
So the cabinet and the league decide that they're going to join forces because the Shadow Thief has animated their own shadows to fight them.
Wow.
It's kind of a cool concept.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Superman and Icon, the most powerful members of their teams, are sitting on a rock in space talking about, you know, the situation they find themselves in. And Icon is telling Superman how he's a transformative figure, which I believe is Freudian psychology. I'm not sure. It's actually a pretty fascinating discussion. It's one of the only things that works for me in the book when Icon explains to Superman that he's the kind of leader who comes along maybe once in a generation and helps everyone else go to maturity. And then, oh, wait, X-ray vision, there's a big fighty fight.
Uh-oh.
So bear in mind, the Flash was in the first panel of the issue. I make this is an important point.
Okay.
So the League and the Shadow Cabinet, the members that are present on the Watchtower, are fighting their own shadows. Fighty, 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 fighty. Meanwhile, Batman and a couple of other Leaguers are down on Earth. At which point, one of the greatest milestone characters of all, Rocket the Unwed Mother.
Oh, I was going to say Static?
No, Rocket.
Okay.
Makes her return. Rocket actually stares down the Batman and explains to him that if he doesn't listen to her, she's going to kick his ass so hard that by the time he wakes up, his cape will be back in style. That's an oh snap moment
does
right
she,
there.
Does she cause Batman to back down?
Batman stops. He says, all right, I'll listen to what you have to say.
Oh, man.
Which I really appreciate.
Oh,
so,
man.
Yeah, it's nice. You got to give her props.
All the
I
while.
Believe mad props.
All the while, he's going, just another 5 more minutes and I'll be able to take this bee down.
Right. Yep. In another 5 minutes, I'll be dead and I won't have to worry about crossovers for about 6 months.
Yeah.
And by dead, I mean in a cave in the year 1957 BC. So, the fighty fighty. And the fighty fighty's got some moments. And
so,
Red Arrow, ugh, and Hawk Girl have their little moment where they argue about whether they love each other in the middle of a fight for their death, because that's the best time to do it.
Well, it worked
and
for Mr. and Mrs.
the
Smith.
Moment, which makes me think that the whole issue is lost.
Okay.
Remember, the Flash was in the first panel of the issue.
Right. Where is he?
They make one of the biggest plot points is the Flash breaking out of the alternate dimension, seemingly having always been trapped inside of the dimension that Twilight leads to. And he comes out and fights his own shadow. And there's a cute moment where they're like, hey, he outran his own shadow. Ha ha. This is the kind of thing that you need an editor for. The artist should not be able to muddy up a story by putting the wrong figure in the first panel of the book. This is, I mean, seriously, this to me is
sloppy,
relatively
editing.
Unforgivable. It's not bad enough that we have books where they're misspelling the name of the character as F-A-L-S-H, the Falsh.
It's, you know, the Falsh.
I had that earlier today. Oh, man.
Yeah.
It was not a Falsches. Pleasant. The Falshes.
And then, so at this point, I'm officially disgusted with the issue.
Are you sure it wasn't
and
another
everything
Flash?
Comes together and there's more fighty-fighty. And the unbelievable godlike power of the Shadow Thief is taken out in two panels by the second Dr. Light, who, don't get me wrong, is a character that I enjoy, but
I
who
think
is
she's
not
kinda bitchy.
Really... Not really one of DC's greatest superhumans.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we find out that the whole plan that he had was to send the dark shadow of the moon to destroy the Earth.
Dun, dun, dun.
And the characters literally stand around for about 2 pages trying to figure out a way to do this before Superman says, oh, I'll just ram into it at high speed and crush it with my big rubbery head. And he does. So they got that going for him.
Is that the end of the arc?
That's the end of the issue.
No,
the Shadow Cabinet teleports away. There's a moment where we see Dharma, the leader of the Shadow Cabinet, explaining how he knows that Batman won't be a problem, and we see a flash forward to the dead Batman from Final Crisis.
Ah, okay.
And that's it. And then we have one of those little two-page things where the scarred guardian of Oa tells us the history of the characters and gives us a portent and... But a horrible, horrible darkness is in their future.
Yeah, which
because,
I don't believe.
Because, you know, DC Comics have been such full of sweetness and light for the past 7 years.
I just don't believe that. Okay,
coming out of Final Crisis. Overall, I like Dwayne McDuffie. Dwayne McDuffie is a good writer. Dwayne McDuffie does excellent dialogue. This whole arc has not worked for me. And this issue, as a capstone to it, really falls completely apart. There's no real clear understanding of what it is the Shadow Thief wants other than to start the fighty-fighty. The art is designed to knock off what's his face, Ed Benes.
Oh yeah, I love his work.
Oh, do you?
I do.
Ed Benes is not an artist whose craft you want to be mimicking. Okay,
right.
Ed Benes has a very specific art style, and it's like Todd McFarlane. Either you are Todd McFarlane or you're not doing it right. And the artist does not capture any of the things that make Ed Benes's art charming.
Yeah.
But he manages to capture everything that makes Ed Benes's art a titanic pain to look at. This whole issue is it's almost incoherent. I don't know what it is. I think the whole point of it was to establish that the Shadow Cabinet exists in the DC Universe main earth. It could have been done in far less than three issues, and there's no real point. I mean, there's no threat that makes sense, and if something is – if a threat is that giant and that tremendous, it shouldn't be just, hey, throw Superman at it.
Right.
We should have some sort of collaborative effort between these. I mean, if it's – you know, I would have bought Superman and Icon together.
Yeah.
In one of those moments where, you know, the big two characters who really kind of represent their universes go into battle and now it's a unified front. But I can't give this issue more than one slice of meatloaf. It's just not good.
All right. So here's my – yeah, go ahead.
Don't take calls.
Okay. I was going to say that as you were doing your review, I went through my stack of unread comics that are here that I still plan on getting to at some point. Maybe not reviewing, but just at least reading.
Uh-huh.
Because of the way that I get my comics here in the middle of nowhere, you know, I really don't have a say. You know, I can't flip through it at the stand and say, oh, no, thanks. I'm not going to buy this piece of crap. And because I want to support my comic book guy, you know, I order 3 months ahead. So when it's here, I take it. That doesn't mean I'm going to read it.
Mm-hmm.
I was flipping through the stack of my unread comics. And I was like, well, where the hell is this JLA? I know I saw the cover to it. And then I realized, you know what? This is the one that I put in the stack of I'm probably never going to read. And it's sitting in a pile in the comic book room at this point of comics I will probably never read because it does not interest me.
And you have made the right choice. You want to know the greatest injustice
of
all?
You chose wisely.
Look at the cover.
Yeah, that weird shadow weirdness.
Well, the shadow thing isn't the issue.
Okay.
Look at Superman's belt.
I don't have it here in front of me. It's in the room of the pile of I'm not reading this stuff.
They have drawn Superman using the Superman Returns costume with the Speedo, the S-Shield belt, and the big rubbery boots.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the character is apparently supposed to look like Brandon Routh, but
weird.
I mean, to me, that's insult to injury.
Page 3.
You know, you're referencing Superman Returns, which is, to me, one of the inescapable and inexcusable sins of the comic book industry in the last 10 years. And that's all I got to say about that.
Page 3.
So let's go do something good.
Page 3.
Page 3. It's time.
Boop, 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 for Husqvarna, Bose Radio.
The Bose Wave Radio.
I love Paul Harvey.
I did. Paul Harvey was one of those transformative figures.
What did he transform into?
And he taught us the power of a well-placed pause.
You want to say pause.
Pause.
P-A-W-S. A well-placed pause.
P-A-W. Speaking of well-placed pause.
It's Saturday.
LOL.
Both of the members of our major spoilers poll of the week have some enormous pause on them, if you see what I'm saying, because their hands are huge.
Oh, man.
I'm trying to transition better than Steven.
Hey, speaking of transitions.
Hey, speaking of transitions.
Let's get Matthew to do a whole Sophie's Choice this week.
Oh, man.
Drunken 5-year-olds, Steven. Could transition better than that. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls.
Can't wait till I get a drunk 5-year-old.
Once the reviews are over, it means that each of us must turn our inner forces, the very fiber fabric thingy of our being, towards an unescapableness thing. The major spoilers poll of the week.
It's time for the poll.
Every poll.
My wife is throwing things at me from across the room.
Ooh, we need to get
it's
her.
Time for the poll.
We need to get her to weigh in this week.
No, we don't. My wife's not allowed to speak on the podcast. So, now she's giving me the finger. Once again, this week, the poll of the week is all about me, and I like bacon. It's all about something that rhymes with bacon. That's a wrestling reference for the three people that got it.
Yeah.
Steven, being a bastard.
I don't understand any wrestling.
Has decided that this week, last week, of course, it was two of my favorite little crushy purple-haired girls, and he forced me to choose between them. This week, we're pitting, honestly, probably my top two favorite comic book characters of all time in an arena of death. Hailing from Marvel Comics, standing 6 foot two or thereabouts, or approximately 4 inches, depending on who drew the issue. Calvin R. Rankin.
Oh, man.
The second leader of the Mighty X-Men. First recruit to Professor Xavier's group of mutant F-heads. Duplicating the powers of anyone he encounters, he is an unstoppable force. Hailing from the Legion of Superheroes, weighing in at approximately 6 ounces, depending on whether your issue is in 6.0 or 8.0 condition. The man from Dryad, last survivor of the planet. Once a member of the Legion of Super Assassins, now he stands on the side of good. He is known only as Block. And by the way, F you, Steven.
I think I'd make a good supervillain. I got the shaved head. Yeah. I'm rubbing my hands together and laughing maniacally. Choose, Matthew, choose which one should live and which one should die.
It's like you're making me pick between my children. My actual child next to you should be ashamed of yourself. You all right?
Yes, I'm fine.
Need a moment? This week we're going back to the Battle of the Battles. Stop it. Two people fight until one of them is no longer there.
So here's the question, because I had a tough time making this decision.
Yes.
Mimic can duplicate any X-Men powers, or he can duplicate anybody's powers.
Well, there's a couple of issues with that, see. When we're dealing with the Earth 616 version of the Mimic, the actual version that appeared in the Marvel Universe, and not the version from Exiles, which had different power limitations.
Right.
He can duplicate the powers, depending on who you believe, of anyone or other mutants.
So how is Mimic different than Rogue?
Well, he's not, in that he's... And if you notice, Rogue is a hot chick version of the Mimic, and that's why she's successful.
Aha! Mm-hmm.
But he does not require physical touch in order to trigger his powers.
Okay.
One of the differentiations between the Mimic and Rogue is that when the Mimic showed up, he started developing the powers of the X-Men because they went to high school together.
Hmm.
At a point in time when the characters were going to school off the Xavier campus. Hmm. Now, at no point in those original stories did it put limits on his powers, because he passed all of his classes by duplicating the knowledge of his professors.
Right.
Hmm.
And he was the star athlete at school by duplicating the abilities of the more talented people on the basketball and football teams.
Now, follow-up
question.
So
he can duplicate abilities that aren't superpowers.
Follow-up question.
Yes.
Can he have multiple powers at the same time, or is he a one-power wonder?
If you look at the image that you posted...
Yeah, I cut off the Wolverine claws.
You cut off the... Well, he didn't have Wolverine claws in that picture.
Yeah, he did.
He would have had beast hands. No, he didn't.
He had these razors shooting out of the ends of his fist.
Oh, you may be thinking... Oh, okay, the other image.
Oh, okay. The one with
the
wings.
The one where he has the big red visor.
Yeah, okay. All right.
In that picture, he has the angel's wings and the beast's hands and feet.
Okay.
At one point, he was able to use Iceman's powers and Cyclops' powers together.
Ah, okay.
So the difficulty here comes down to whether you believe in versatility over power. Block, of course, has one essential power, and that is that his fists are 4 feet wide.
Yeah.
He's big and he's strong, and he'll come up and he will hit you until you are dead, dead, dead. Whereas the Mimic has the ability to fly. He has the ability to attack from a distance with two separate powers, telekinesis and laser eyes. In fact, when you take this into account, and I wanted to go off on this tangent for a second, you know who the Mimic really is?
Who?
Siler.
Yeah, there you go. I was going to say Everyman from 52.
No, the Mimic is actually a character who is driven by bitterness and hatred of being an outsider. He has issues with his father. He's duplicating the powers of others. One of his primary abilities was always telekinesis, but he also has the ability to fly and manipulate energy. He's Siler.
Yep.
Or he's what Siler is drawing from to some degree. So when people say Siler is an entirely new, you know, different take on superheroes, I usually say something along the lines of...
And I would point everybody back to our two past podcasts where we talk about X-Men Envy.
Mm-hmm. X-Men Envy, exactly. And the people who write X-Men, or rather heroes, say that there's no X-Men influence. And given how minor the Mimic is, they're probably right. Mm. But the guy's got maybe 15 appearances, 20 tops.
Really? I thought he had more to be ranked up there in one of your favorites. This has been
first
a favorite of yours for
X-Men
like forever.
X-Men number 19, joined the team in 27, was a member of the X-Men. 27, 28, and 29 left the team and died several years later in Hulk and then came back from the dead in an arc in Marvel Comics Presents. Right. So here's the reason why he was my favorite character.
Why is that?
I entered the Marvel Universe bass-ackwards by reading the official handbook of the Marvel Universe.
Ah, okay.
And the official handbook of the Marvel Universe in its initial incarnation was one big picture and about 50 pages of teeny tiny print explaining everything that happened in Marvel Comics over the past 30 years.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Now, if you're me, awesome. You get to sit, you get to read, you got the big pretty picture, and you also get to hear about stories that in your head are ever so much cooler than the way they actually went.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
And one of the first comics I ever bought was the Book of the Dead, Marvel Universe volume 1, number 14. The Book of the Dead, and it introduced me to a lot of characters that are now my favorites. Nova, Omega the Unknown, The Mimic, The 3D Man, characters whose history, whose actual comic stories aren't as good as the stories that I created in my head by reading the backstory and reading the synopsis of what happened to them throughout their comic career.
All right.
The reason The Mimic is my favorite is because he's like orange and he has like stuff and everything. And like his stuff.
All right.
I love that visor.
So, Matthew, you're going to have to sit back for a moment while Rodrigo and I discuss which of your two favorites would die here.
Okay.
Rodrigo?
Well, it's hard to it's really hard to throw it in for Block on account of the fact that The Mimic could probably just copy Block's powers and then have at it. But then again, Block is more familiar with his own powers. So presumably, if Block is smart, and I don't know because I've never read an issue with Block and skipped that hero history. no, that's not true. I actually did read it. I read all like the weird, like the less humanoid the character, the more interested I am in it.
Uh-huh.
So Block could probably work to his advantage if the Mimic did not manage to... learn his ability to hit things really hard that quickly.
Okay.
So I'm gonna go with the Mimic, but I'm not saying the Block would be totally out of the fight. I'm saying it would be a good fight if he plays it right.
I also that's why I asked the question about can the Mimic have multiple powers at the same time.
And he can.
Because I'm gonna go with the Mimic too, because you'd think if you had Cyclops's laser eyes and adamantium claws and the power to blow up people with your brain, I think the Mimic would be able to take Block down pretty easily.
Well, Mimic usually has the powers of the five original X-Men and whatever else is around. So he wouldn't start out with the claws unless Wolverine was there. And let's face it, Wolverine is probably there because he's everywhere.
So he doesn't retain these powers? Mimic doesn't? You have to
Steven,
be in physical presence.
You're confusing two different versions of the Mimic. Okay. The one in Exiles was an alternate universe version.
Mm-hmm.
The 616 version of the Mimic has maintained a portion of the powers of the original five X-Men.
All right.
So I-beams, ice, wings, telekinesis.
Well, freeze him in a block of ice and blow him up with some I-beams. I'm still going for Mimic over Block.
Okay.
So now it's time for you, Matthew. Between your two children, who are you going to pick as your favorite?
I will tell you, this is the first time I have never voted in a Mimic.
That hard, huh?
And I will tell you why.
I love my children equally. It's my children equally. And F you, Steven.
No. Here is what would happen. We're going to go into a realm where I usually don't go. We're going to go to fan fiction.
Uh-oh.
Let's say I'm writing this story.
Okay.
and someone manages to manipulate the original X-Men at a time when the Mimic would have been a member of the X-Men, and the Legion of Superheroes at a time when Block was a member of the Legion of Superheroes. Let's say it's a combination of, I don't know, the Time Trapper and the Grandmaster working in concert for a better America. All right, so you have these two characters. We presume that the rest of the Legion and the rest of the X-Men are somehow taken out of the picture.
Oh, they're all fighting each other somewhere
else. And we have these two characters alone together.
They start making out.
He did say it was fan fiction.
You need to stop with the Kirk Spock slash fic is what I'm saying. You need to put that stuff away. And by the way, Lex and Tom Welling could not have children. If these two characters were working against one another, you have to ask yourself this question. In any fight where you have two characters fighting, and yes, I am in fact stalling for time.
He's flipping a coin.
No.
That's 3 out of 5.
I'm not going to vote, and I'm going to tell you why. I have a rule of thumb when it comes to this. Somebody asked me in 1993, who would win in a fight between Superman and the Hulk?
Don't care.
When DC versus Marvel come out. You know what I said?
Don't care.
No, vote for the guy with the eye beams.
Yeah.
In a fight, pick the guy with the laser eyes because he can attack from a distance.
Right.
But in this case, Block has shown the ability to deflect eye beams.
Okay, there you
remember,
go.
Remember, in his first appearance, he was attacked by the Starburst Bandits, who are considerably more powerful than the Mimic. So I say that if these two characters fight, the winner will be
Thor.
Me. Because I'll get to have a cool story with those two characters. So, 2 votes for Mimic and 1 abstention. Remember, folks, you can go to the Major Spoilers website and vote. For yourself, Steve.
An impressive 242 votes already in, with the Mimic leading with 61% of the vote.
Nice.
Based, of course, on my theory that if you're in a fight, pick the guy with the laser eyes.
Yep. So next week we're gonna pit Matthew's wife against Matthew's daughter.
Well, Stacy's got the height, but Molly's really mean.
He's like a little cat.
And then
cat.
The week after that, we're going to pit Steven against my fist.
Steven wins. Steve,
if you ever hit me and anybody tells me about it, we're going to have a talk.
You can
always weigh in with your opinion on Major Spoilers website, www.majorspoilers.com. If you don't know that, I don't know how you're hearing the podcast, but hey, to each his own. Throw your 2 cents in. Next week, I'm sure Steven will find some other way to torture me. You know who else I love? Vincent from the Black Hole. See who he can kill.
Ooh. Well, let's see. You know, he is one of on my robot list.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Major Spoilers Legion. Legion of Major Spoilers listeners. Who should we pit? And it has to be a robot.
Robot.
Who should we pit Vincent against? And it can't be old Bob.
Right.
No.
Okay? Who can we pit?
And Maximilian has been done.
R2?
Yeah. Oh, there we go. Well, have we done R2 before?
No.
I don't remember. I think we did. I think R2 maybe. Fought Batman or something.
All right. So it'll be so forget that unless some Major Spoilers listener can come up with a better robot. R2-D2 versus Vincent next week. I better write that down.
Yeah, you better, because otherwise next week we're going to be like, hey, Steven had a brain fart.
Well, actually, I do have another.
There's a script for this.
I do have another robot battle coming up. I do have another robot battle coming up, which should be rather interesting, but I'm going to wait.
Robot battle theme song!
Wow.
We are robots. We have come to battle.
Page 4.
The robots are dead.
Love.
Page 4? Hey. This week, again, depending on when you listen to the show. Yes, this week, one of the highly anticipated Husqvarna products reaches your store. It's the hedge trimmer and small brush cleaner at an amazing low price of $300. Now, Rodrigo and I have had a chance to take out this Husqvarna hedge and trim cleaner cutter.
Isn't that how you shaved your head in Rodrigo's
Well, now you know. We're going to talk about that this week on the show.
Baby smooth and no weeds.
No, we're actually talking about the biggest movie probably of all time. Maybe even, I don't know, is this going to be bigger than Batman?
It has a potential to be bigger than Batman because it's definitely jumping off of the fact that a lot of people went to see The Dark Knight and really liked it.
Yeah. This week we're going to be talking about The Watchmen. Time magazine named it as one of the best novels of all time.
Hmm.
It is probably one of the deepest comic books, or I'm sorry, graphic novels, that you will probably ever read.
It was a comic book first, by the way. I have all 12 issues.
All right, good for you. One of the biggest comic books of all time, written by Alan Moore.
Steven.
Written by Alan Moore, illustrated by Dave Gibbons. Man, where to begin? Start, it's, you know what?
Let's go page by page.
Let's go page by page.
Page one.
It grabs you
it
from the very beginning.
It does. It grabs you by the balls and throws you out the window with a little bloody smiley face following you all the way down. And just when you think you have it figured out and you're going to look out and scream for help, I'm going to look down and say no. You know, on the very broad surface, and I think this is what kind of attracted me to it, was that it's a murder mystery about who killed this guy, Edward Blake, the comedian. Right. And you could read this through that way, and read it as a murder mystery that turns into something totally ripped off of Outer Limits.
Hey.
Or you could read it on a very deep scale of what are we deconstructing superheroes. You could go even deeper than to look at the... And something I didn't even realize until just recently, and I don't know how I missed this, how the layout and the graphic design itself plays a big part...
Oh, yeah.
In this book.
You missed the layout?
Well, you know, the first... Okay, so let's start here.
The story is engrossing enough that
it
you
is,
might...
I that
mean,
I just,
you
I
absorb
do not
it,
think,
but you don't really analyze
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I don't think about panel layout. It's something I do not do. And let's start with, how did you guys find The Watchmen? And I think, Matthew, you've already told us your story, right? About you jumped on it, like, issue 9 or something?
Issue 9, it was the story... where Laurie and John are on Mars.
Right.
And I just dropped into the middle of this and I'm like, I have no idea what's going on, but I have never been more fascinated by a story. It was that impressive, that transformative. Hey, there's that word for the 15th time today.
Today's word is transformative.
I probably remember seeing The Watchmen in trade and maybe even the single issues back when it was first released in, what, 85, 86?
86.
And I probably just kind of passed it by because at that time I was really more into some more of the pulpy heroes. So I was reading like Doc Savage and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Batman, you know, that kind
That's
of
That's the way I
stuff.
Like my orange
yeah,
juice,
pulpy.
By the way.
It wasn't until probably my sophomore or junior year in college where I was stuck in this godforsaken town for a whole summer with nothing to do but go to work at the radio station every day, which meant I had a lot of time to kill. And I went
I
down
remember
to
that crappy little apartment.
I know
you had
that
off like
yeah,
Fourth
Second Street.
Street.
Yeah, that crap ass apartment, no air conditioning, about the size
$115 a month, and you like, felt like a king.
It was like $100 a month, something like that. So I had some extra time, and I went down to Gulliver's Tattered Covers, and I was just
would have been down on the railroad tracks where it rightfully
time.
Belongs, by God.
And I was just buying trade after trade after trade that summer and just reading it. So I read through, you know, the Phoenix Saga. I read through, I think, Ronin. I read through V for Vendetta. And then I was like, well, what else can I get to? Okay, let me try this Watchmen thing. And it took me about a week to read through it because it's not something I think you can read in a single setting. And my initial reaction was meh the first time I read it. But as Alan Moore has said, this is something that really needs 5 or 6 reads to really get into a bunch of different levels. So after I was done with it, I set it aside for a week, and I think I read that when I read The Dark Phoenix. And then came back to this Watchmen again and started to get into the story and started reading some of the subtext and started reading some of the other stuff. And that's when I really kind of got it and enjoyed the book the second time. Rodrigo, what about you?
Well, in 1986,
Rodrigo had not been born yet.
I was 3 years old. So I didn't really encounter Watchmen until much, much later, obviously. I would see it as a trade paperback just kind of sitting around, and I'd be like, oh, this bright yellow thing looks interesting. It kind of looks like Scud, the disposable assassin, which, you know, of course it's nothing like it.
Right.
And I, be-
I believe in Rodrigo's native country, it's referred to El Hombres del Timex.
Yeah. El Watchmano. No. It's called El Saint Shark.
I went to this church the other day. I was praying to Saint Shark for my lost keys.
Yeah. Patron saint of chums. Adam West is all about it. I went to it and I was like, oh, awesome. Opened it up. And I was like, wow, this art does not speak to me at all. Close, put away.
That was my first reaction, because many a times I'd seen that trade sitting there on the shelf and I'd open it up and be like, big blue naked guy, not really keen on the color, not really keen on the art. I'm going to put it back until I was so desperate for material that I said, okay, let me give it a try.
You know, going back and as you were saying, it's the cinematography of Watchmen that is amazing. And at the first time I encountered it, just the layout, essentially, the first time I encountered it, I wasn't looking for that.
Right.
It wasn't until much, much later when a friend of mine was like, dude, seriously, I'm not going to talk to you anymore until you reach Watchmen. And I was like, all right, well, if it's that important, I'll pick it up. And, you know, I started reading it. I got past my hangups with the art. And then at that point, I was actually in film school. I was a freshman at Northwestern. And I was like, oh, wow, this is actually...
Wait, where did you go to school? I think we forgot.
Oh, come on, it doesn't come up that often.
Has it been 20 minutes already?
Allow me to plug the Comics Revolution, the comic book store in Evanston. It's actually pretty good. It also has a good gaming section.
Oh, okay, there you go.
Probably not as expensive as Gatekeeper, but it's
well, well, come tune engage, Topeka, Kansas.
Ask us about whatever the hell else I put out last week.
Ask us about our extensive collection of Watchmen trades.
Anyway,
we have like 30.
As I was saying, while I was going to one of the best schools in the country, I was, and then somehow ended up in the middle of nowhere.
I thought you
said
you went to Northwestern instead of USC.
Oh, man.
I could never decide whether I wanted to go to UCLA or USC, so I went to Fort Hays.
UCLA? There's a school called UCLA? Thunder! The UCLA Thunders. That would be awesome.
That would be awesome.
What are we talking about? Oh, yeah, Watchmen.
Watchmen, yeah. Back on topic.
Yeah, basically...
Actually, my degree in psychological studies from Thunder. My master's degree. Never mind.
So you read it the first time. Your friend forces it in your hand and says, yep. Rodrigo, I'm going to bitch slap you if you don't read
right.
this.
And I did. And I was like, okay, I'm going to read the whole thing. I'm going to read every last word in it. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people who read through it and totally skipped the inserts in the middle.
Yeah.
That just talked about owls.
Right.
And stuff about that. A lot of people just, after the first couple panels, they were like, I'm not reading this Black Freighter crap.
Right.
And honestly, sometimes I wish I hadn't.
Yeah.
Because it's a really, really, really long joke that ends with better Nate than Lever. I'll tell you guys that joke later.
Okay.
So there's a snake, right?
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
And you know what the Chihuahua had in his mouth? The brick.
So I read it all the way through and I was just amazed. I mean, it was what everybody said it was, which is this deconstruction of the superhero as a person, you know,
right.
What do you do with people with superpowers? What do people without superpowers do in reaction to a person with superpowers? How would people really react in this very paranoid society? And you got to understand, I was in Mexico in the 80s, so there wasn't that...
A lot of paranoia going on.
That huge doomsday sense that Americans had in the 80s, like, it didn't even permeate to Mexico. And I was a kid, so...
Didn't you have death squads running around, though?
Sure, but that's always been that way.
Okay.
You're thinking of Paraguay, I believe.
Okay.
I approached it from the sense of, you know, each individual character and basically what it means to be a vigilante to each of them.
Mm-hmm.
The whole paranoia thing didn't hook me because I really honestly didn't live through it.
Does
which actually made the end of it a little bit less impressive to me. Because, again, it's sort of that huge release of
Right.
You know, of the Paranoian pulling off the master plan.
Right.
To me, it just seemed like the end.
You're talking about deconstructing the hero. Unfortunately, The Dark Knight Returns had already come out before this. This was a time period when it seemed like all the characters across every comic book company were trying to make their heroes darker and grittier and more realistic.
Not in 86.
Isn't
86 was the year of the crisis at DC. I mean,
oh, right.
86 was the year that Spider-Man, I believe, got engaged. I mean,
no, but I mean the 80s in general, though, especially the late 80s.
A lot of what you perceive as the grim and grittiness really came after Dark Knight and Watchmen.
Right.
There was actually a time, I'm almost certain, when the books were coming out monthly at the same time. Because I know I did not buy Dark Knight Returns and I didn't care for it, but I'm almost certain that there was a time when I could have bought it
at
roughly
the same time, yeah.
An equivocal period in 86. Yeah.
Why is it important that we deconstruct the superhero?
Because at the time, there was a sea change in the way the comics companies were looking at what their readership and what their business was. They say that back in the day, Mort Weisinger, who was running the Superman franchise for DC, didn't have a problem with revamping or flat out reusing old stories every couple of years because he believed that the fan base was kids and the fan base turned over about every 3 to 5 years.
Right.
By the early 70s, the fans started running the company, and by the 80s, it was really the beginning of what we see now where the people running comics, the people writing comics and in comics were doing it because they were fans for people who were already fans. And there weren't as many fans being created. The deconstruction came from the aging of the fan base. When
right.
You're 12 and 13, bouncing boy outwitting Orion the Hunter may start to look less impressive. By the time you're 25, when you've seen the Most Dangerous Game riff with bouncing boy outwitting the Hunter or Batman outwitting Ra's al Ghul or, you know, for all intents and purposes, Spy-Man outwitting Dr. Doofenshmirtz.
Or, you know, John Leguizamo doing it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
As the Pest. Yeah. When you get to that point, there is a desire amongst the characters for more depth, for more personal stories. And what happened with Watchmen, to me, can be summed up in a very simple but long-winded manner. And I got to start it with a digression. What a shock. When I'm writing the hero histories, I find myself consciously and unconsciously trying to shake up the way I describe the characters. So instead of saying every time Tom Welling, I'll say young Kal-El or the last son of Krypton, to where I'm not saying Lightning Lad did this, then Lightning Lad did that, then Lightning Lad did this. And I find myself, when the characters are having personal moments, like currently when Saturn Girl does something heroic as Saturn Girl, my brain wants to call her Saturn Girl.
Mm-hmm. Right.
When we're talking about her child, about her marriage, about her family, my brain wants to call her Imra.
Mm-hmm.
When I refer to the characters in Watchmen, not intentionally, I did it 5 or 10 minutes
right.
ago.
John,
I don't
Dr.
talk
Manhattan.
About Dr. Manhattan. I talk about John. I talk about Lori and Dan and Blake. These are the names of the people. And the story is not about superheroes. The story is about disillusionment. It's about the weird 80s era paranoia. It's about a woman coming to terms with her mother's legacy and her father's. It's about a man in his 40s realizing that maybe he is more than he thought, even though he's not what he hoped to be. It's about, God help us, Walter Kovach coming to terms with all of the psychoses rattling around in his skull. There's a lot going on in this story, and almost none of it has anything to do with the capes and the masks, to the point where when we get to that quintessential cape and mask moment at the end, it kind of falls flat. Because we've had so much interaction. We talk about the moment where, you know, Blake shows up at Moloch's bedside crying drunk, and the only friend, the only person that he could think of that he could share this moment, this horrifying, life-altering moment with, is a guy that he's been fighting off and on for 30 years.
Yeah, true.
Because his life is so empty that he only has the people that he fights, and most of them are dead.
Hmm. So, Rodrigo, then essentially we're talking about the heroes have to get to their lowest point in order to find out what makes them a hero. Mm-hmm. Or in the case of Ozymandias, he gets to the...
What makes them not a hero.
Yeah, he gets to the point where he realizes that he could become greater if he painted everyone else in a bad light.
Mm.
And I again, you know, I read the Black Freighter, or tried to read through the Black Freighter, because it was really this story within a story.
Mm-hmm.
And it really detracts, it really takes you out of this murder mystery.
Yeah.
But in the end, the story of the Black Freighter is about Ozymandias.
Yeah.
It is a story about how here's a character that has to give away everything that he believes in, you know, making a raft out of his comrades, eating his dead comrades, killing these people.
Yep. Sacrifice everything that he is, every last ounce of humanity.
Right. To try to protect everyone else. And in the end, though, he kills those things that he holds dear. And that ends up being what Ozymandias does when he comes up with this plot to
save the world.
Save the world. And in the end, he kills a lot of the things that he loves.
Mm-hmm.
But he knows going in that that's going to happen. Ozymandias, to me, is kind of like a more and less three-dimensional Gordon Gekko type character, that 80s archetype of the ultimate businessman, the ultimate success story. And one of the things that I've, you know, tried to remember in my management career as an ineffectual middle management suck-up is that sometimes you have to make the unpopular decisions when you're in charge.
Oh, yeah.
And Adrian Veidt makes a decision based on what he sees as the best for everyone. It's an unpopular decision. It ends up getting a lot of people killed. It sacrifices a lot of his own humanity, his life, his friends, you know, but it does it for what he perceives to be a greater good. And then when you get to the end and you see him just rapturous, thrilled, unbelievable. You know, he has this moment where it's all come to fruition for him and he's done what he needed to do and he feels like he survived. You know, he got through it just like the man from the Black Freighter as he rode down towards his home, hoping, you know, that his wife and his family are there. And then John tells him that nothing ever ends.
Right.
And makes him realize
that he has to
what he's done is a temporary stopgap at best. And he's obviously, he's crestfallen, he's heartbroken. It's everything that he knows is gone. And yes, maybe he did this, but everything that he knows is gone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is why a sequel to this will never fly.
Right. So the thing I think that shocks me the most about this story, and again, we're really talking about the end of this story as opposed to everything that's come up before it.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to discuss it. The end of the story has, you know, Night Owl and Rorschach trying to confront Ozymandias over this, and Ozymandias pulling the best villain monologuing moment ever. You think I'm going to talk? So that you have a chance to, you know, thwart my plan. I executed my plan 35 minutes ago or however many minutes ago it was.
Yeah. I'm not a Republic serial villain, Dan. I did this half an hour ago. Yes.
Such a brilliant moment where you go, damn, this guy knows what he's going. And
he does it on panel. We don't know what he does, but they literally show him pushing the button on panel right before they arrive.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But here's the thing that kind of, I don't know, maybe disturbed me a little bit, because here's Dr. Manhattan and Lori, the Silk Spectre, show up, and they all kind of, after listening to Ozymandias's reasoning,
mm-hmm.
say, you know what? You're right.
Yeah.
And Rorschach...
Well, Dan and Lori do.
Right. And to a lesser or greater extent, Dr. Manhattan, because he's being the all... knowing one, knows that he just has a part to play in this. So he's mm-hmm. more like a puppet going through the motions. But of course, then there's Rorschach who says, well, screw this. I'm not going along with this.
Mm-hmm.
And then the shock then of Dr. Manhattan saying, sorry, buddy.
Yep.
And kills him. I mean, the fact that here we've built these characters up throughout the story as they're facing their own difficulties. Here's Dan going through his midlife crisis, being impotent until he puts on the costume, getting the girl that he could never possibly hope of getting.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going, yeah, here's a guy that's really going to be a hero. And then in the end, you're going, son of a bitch, you're no better than Ozymandias.
Yeah.
No. Rorschach could never have had a happy ending. And part of it is where he comes from.
Right.
Rorschach in that whole issue is probably the closest and most evocative of his origin in the whole Charlton Heroes. When Steve Ditko created the question lives in a world of absolutes,
right.
Of black and white. You are morally right or you are morally wrong, period. That carries over into Rorschach. Rorschach could not survive in the world that was created by what Adrian did at the end of the series. Rorschach begged him to kill him. There's no possible way that Rorschach was going to have a happy ending.
Yeah.
And the story of Rorschach's actual origin, not when he became the character, but the night that he transformed and fully became Rorschach,
right.
Mm-hmm.
Is so horrifying that when John kills him on panel, I felt like it was right. I felt like it was, you know, it was what the character
deserved.
I don't want to say deserved.
Well, maybe it's his piece.
It was his way out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not going to get into any depth about anything involving this, but for Rorschach, the world had changed into something that he could never understand and he could never exist in. And it had been doing it for a long time. It was a long time coming and the transformation took a while. But when he came to the realization, you know,
that he'd rather be dead than live in this world.
He'd rather be dead than live in this world.
So it
world,
was death by cop.
No, because John's purpose, I think, part of John's purpose in being there was to do that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know,
but it's not Rorschach saying, hey, I'm going to kill myself like Moloch did by putting a bullet through my head, if that's really what happened. But I'm going to have somebody else kill me, so therefore it's not suicide, so therefore I go out still being the quote-unquote, air quote, good guy. I still go out being the good guy. Do you see that? I mean, that's, again,
no,
this black and white.
I don't really see it like that. I think Rorschach, for all intents and purposes, went down fighting. He just went down fighting a tank. I mean, he was backed up against the wall. There was absolutely nothing he could do, and he did not back down.
Yeah,
he was like, "Hey, man, look, if you don't back down, you're gonna ruin. I can't let you ruin this plan.
Right.
So it's either you go along or you die." And he was like, "Well, then kill me. Go ahead and kill me now. There's nothing I can do about it."
Right.
But
his last words were, "Do it."
Yep.
Screaming it at the top of his lungs. But again, that describes that character. And the responses of the other characters. What's the first thing that Laurie does when she finds out that everything she knows is wrong?
She throws up.
She grabs Dan and she has sex with him.
Mm.
Now, at that time, she probably has a great deal of affection for him, and I'm sure she starts to love him. But her response to a situation out of her control is to do something entirely physical.
Is this
to, you know, do something entirely about, I don't know if you want to say celebrating life, but something that is about being a living organism.
Is this before or after she finds out that Edward Blake is her father via rape?
This after.
Okay.
She finds out that Blake is her father on Mars in issue 9.
Right.
At the end, when they find out that Viet's plan has apparently seemingly worked and she, you know, everything's done, Rorschach is blown up, she and Dan go back into Adrian's little pool area,
yeah, and get it on.
Basically, she nails him.
But that's not the first time they've had sex, though, because they've had sex back when they went out on their first, essentially the first mission of the Minutemen, following, you know,
with
the fire rescue, and that's when they're like, "Ooh, this is kind of exciting, and let's get caught up in the moment, and let's get it on."
See, and that's something else about it, that these are characters who are capable of heroism. They're not heroic characters,
right?
Rorschach is nuts. And Laurie is, you know, Laurie is basically kind of a synthesis of her parents. She shares
some of her mother's tendency to be way too blunt and way too brassy. And her, you know, the moment where she channels her old man, the old lady's trying to get on the owl ship, and she's like, I don't care about your effing medicine, just get in the ship, you asshole.
Right.
You know, that is the moment that you look at. She's trying to save this person's life. She's not going to brook any crap while doing it.
Do you think when Rorschach died, he knew he was going to win in the end because his journal had gotten out, was sent to the New Frontiersman newspaper?
I don't think that's important.
You don't?
I don't, and the reason why is because I'm a fan of The Twilight Zone. If you've ever seen the very first episode of The Twilight Zone, it's called Where Is Everybody? And it features Earl Holliman walking around in what seems to be this post-apocalyptic wasteland with no other humans. And it's never explained. And at the end, well, at one point he goes and he sits through a movie. And at the end, we find that he was actually in a government testing lab.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
He was
locked in
isolation.
The tank, yeah.
And as they carry him away, a ticket stub from the movie theater falls out of his pocket.
Yeah.
That's the point where it's now your story. It doesn't matter what Rod Serling intended. It doesn't matter what, you know, may happen with Rorschach's journal, except in as much as it matters to you, the reader.
Well, but could that
and
also
that's
be
the thing.
Could that also be what Doc Manhattan was talking about when he was saying, you know, this is only a temporary
nothing
solution.
Ever,
you know, nothing's ever permanent.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, well, take it from a realistic perspective. This is a journal written in
crazy man
and
talk.
somebody makes the remark that Rorschach's handwriting is either so cramped as to be illegible or some elaborate code.
Yeah.
And the character Seymour is a minor intern at this Looney Tune left-wing publication. So even if it gets printed, it's going to be printed by a Looney Tune left-wing publication. So maybe 200,000 conspiracy theorists know about this and think it might be true. It's not important that that happens. It's just that moment it ends. It has to end because nothing ever really ends. It has to end in a way that isn't an ending.
Life's a Glitch.
If that makes any sense.
No, it makes sense. Life's a Glitch says Watchmen is good. Come on, every single positive thing that can be said about Watchmen has already been said, 99% of it right on the money. But that said, Alan Moore sure can write characters, and I find Watchmen to be very character-driven. So here's the question for you guys. Which characters are your favorites, and why? Any characters from the book can be chosen, from the original Night Owl to the psychiatrist that resembles the fat cop from Die Hard. Maybe you even have one specific one that you find more interesting and unique than the others. Rodrigo.
For me, there's no beating Rorschach. Rorschach is an incredible character. He is absolutely – he is crazier than Batman at his craziest moments.
Mm-hmm.
He is that archetype of the dark loner, taking to such an extreme as to actually make him unappealing, which actually rubber bands you back to making him extremely appealing. Like,
right.
Such a sick sense, he mm-hmm. is so – interesting.
He is the id.
Absolutely. Well, and actually, he's so extreme. You could argue that he's the superego.
But you would maybe say Ozymandias is the superego because they're polar opposites. Those two are polar opposites.
I would
opposites
have to say that
another.
John is the superego.
Well,
okay.
There you go.
All right. So, well, but Ozymandias definitely is the ego or the superego.
Right. The thing about Rorschach is, again, he's so out there that morality sort of falls off somewhere along the line, as with a lot of the other characters.
Right.
And you are able to see him, like, to see his core. To him, the important part is not that the world was safe. The important part is that people are being lied to.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that bothers him. And I can empathize with that.
Right.
Furthermore, I love the character design.
Yeah.
That mask, a mask that is constantly changing. I mean, what does that say to you?
Right.
You know, it's like, here's a character who at his core has this completely, like a very human, but simultaneously very alien set of values.
Right.
But his face always looks different mm-hmm. every time you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
He is an incomprehensible creature that is somehow more human than you. Is how I see Rorschach.
Okay.
The black and the white are always separate. They never mix.
Yep. Personally, I'm going to go with Dan, mainly because I think he represents more of the you and me type person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's this
you
guy.
If you mean you and me, I'd say yes.
Yeah, maybe not Rodrigo. But, you know, he got into being the Night Owl because he was a fanboy of the original Night Owl. You know, mm-hmm. to the point where up until the original Night Owl gets brutally murdered by a rampaging mob, he is the ultimate fanboy in the Watchmen universe.
Yep.
But he ends up becoming what most fanboys become. Overweight, balding, trying to find out where they belong in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And then he discovers that he does have a place and does have a purpose, and that regenerates him and revives him. And I think that that reflects a lot of us. And by us, I mean Matthew and I.
Right.
And so I find him probably, I think, the most interesting character because he's trying to do what's right. And ultimately, again, this thing where you're really hoping that he punches out Ozymandias, and then in the end he goes, you know what? You are doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Go for it, you know. Too late, I already did, 30 minutes ago. So that's my favorite character. Matthew?
See, in my normal fashion, it's probably a four-part answer.
Uh-oh. How about a two-part answer?
My very favorite character I want to save for last. And there's a good reason
okay.
why. I'm a really... You know who I really like in the story?
Who?
Bernard and Bernard.
The news
the news vendor and the little kid.
Oh, yeah.
Throughout the story, we see him, you know, doing his whole thing and talking about blah, blah, blah. And he seems like he's this standard issue comedy character. And when we get to the moment where something happens, his first instinct is to save that boy's life.
Right. Because they've been going
at
each other.
He throws himself. Yeah. And it's just some little brat kid who sits at his comic store or sits at his newsstand and reads his comics and annoys him every day. But it's. If you look at Bernard's existence, he never talks to anybody else. That kid may be the closest thing Bernard has to a friend, to a son.
Mm-hmm.
And at the point where he's like, well, your name's Bernard too. And then he, you know, he gives his life to try and save the boy's life. Minor, insignificant character all of a sudden has this huge moment where you look at it and you're like, oh my God, that is as heroic as anything Dan or Laurie did throughout the whole book.
Right.
I like Joey. The cop or the cab driver who keeps throughout showing up. And at the end, we find out that Joey is actually a lesbian named Josephine.
Nice.
Who's been fighting with her girlfriend. And she has an emotional breakdown and she cries on panel. And everybody's like, oh, my God, this is awkward.
Right.
And then they die.
Who is your most favorite character?
Sally Jupiter.
Which one? Oh, the mother of Silk, the Silk Spectre mother. Yeah.
Sally Jupiter, yeah. Because of all of the characters, if you look at. The original characters,
the Minutemen, the original Minutemen.
The Minutemen. Ooh, another time reference.
Yep.
I was thinking Crime Busters. The Crime Busters was what Captain Metropolis wanted to call the team in 68. The Minutemen mostly either died, gave up being whatever it was they were being, or were, you know, completely changed, whether they went crazy, whether, you know, something put them around the bend, whatever. Sally is one of those characters, and you see them, it's like Sunset Boulevard.
Right.
She knows that she's lived well past her prime, the point where whatever it was that made her what she thought she needed to be at her very essential core is no longer there. And she's having to, you know, she's still alive, and she's having to deal with being, you know, an old lady and all of this happening around her and near her, but none of it really happening to her.
Mm-hmm.
And trying, you know, trying to deal with, you know, something completely normal, which is my daughter hates me and I have a secret.
Yeah. Well, the fact that she's protecting Lori mm-hmm. almost as long as she can, you know, someone mentions, oh, have you read, I thought you read that chapter in the book that Night Owl wrote that was a tell-all tale.
Right.
And she's like, And then yep. the person's like, never mind.
That was actually Hollis, the original Night Owl,
right.
I think, who said it. No, it wasn't. Never mind.
I forget but who, but I mean, yeah, it's one of those moments where it's like, oh, wait a minute. She's actually protecting her daughter, even though she's kind of in her own kind of, I don't want to say bitchy way, but motherly
right.
way, forced her daughter to become her.
But Sally kind of represents something that you don't get very often in superhero comics, and that's a realistic portrayal of aging. She is
you know, just you're, she's not even like a caricature. You can't say she's like a standard tough old broad because she's not. Sally is one of those characters who really, to me, is our only real first-person look at what happened back in the day.
Yeah.
And as such, it's like, you know, it's one of those fascinating moments where you sit and you talk to your grandma. Well, maybe I only do this. Where you sit and you talk to your grandma about what it was like to be in the Depression.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know? And Sally is a character who you have to love her, even as you want to punch her in the face.
But that's why Dan likes going to see Hollis. Because he likes hearing the old stories of the grand old day when heroes were actually heroes and well thought in the community, as opposed to after the Keene Act when the superhero vigilante was banned.
Yeah. I think it's around issue 9 or 10 where they reprint, and for me, the supplementary material is the point of the book, where they reprint Sally's Playboy interview.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about, and she touches on a couple of things that are really mentioned in the book but are never explicitly stated. Captain Metropolis and Hooded Justice were a couple.
Nice.
Now, see, I skip most of the supplemental material stuff.
Captain Metropolis and Hooded Justice were gay.
Wow.
And the whole team covered up for them. And when the Silhouette was revealed to be gay and they threw her out of the group for, you know, for purposes of publicity, and then she was later killed, Sally talks about how much she regretted that because – they protected Nelson and HJ, but they couldn't protect Silhouette, and she got killed because of it. You know, it's that kind of weird depth that – it's the Neil Gaiman line. All of us contain worlds – it may actually not be Neil Gaiman's line. Actually, I think about it. I read it in a Neil Gaiman book, which says a lot about me. All of us contain worlds unimagined.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody, even the fat cop from Die Hard, has that, you know, rich inner life that nobody knows about.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's what I like about you know, the characters like Sally and Hollis. I also like the editor of the New Frontiersman.
Yeah. Let's take a listen to this audio comment.
All right.
Hi, Major Spoilers. This is Heath from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Regarding the Watchmen, the one vital aspect that makes it incomparable as a comic and at times mimicked by other writers, but probably never executed so well, is the way that the narratives get layered throughout the comic. Consistently, in nearly every panel, we get the dialogue/text serving as one narrative, the art serving as another, and then a third that is both independent, yet weaves in and out of each panel, in a way that adds meaning and affects the general mood. You know, for example, the Black Freighter comic being read over the somewhat mundane street conversations. Each of these three narratives, you know, could be read separately for great effect, but when combined, they create something different altogether. Wondering about your thoughts on this and how it may or may not translate to the film. Thanks, Stephen, Rodrigo, and Matthew. Love the podcast and the site in general. Bye.
Okay, so as he's saying, there are so many different levels that you can examine Watchmen on. We've kind of been focusing on the stories, and we've talked a little bit about the characters. Let's talk about the art.
Okay.
And again, I really did not pay attention to layout and design here until someone pointed out to me, well, you know that they're trying to use this 9-panel layout, which I do understand that. I did recognize that. But when you get to issue 5, and it's a whole mirror of the first page to the last page as far as panel
because
layout
goes. It's about Rorschach.
It's about symmetry, I think, is the name of the name of the issue.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And suddenly I'm just like, blah, 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 blah. When you go and you start reading books like The Art of, or what's this book called that Dave Gibbons just came out with?
Watching the Watchmen.
And he's going into, oh, well, we thought about doing this, and we thought about doing this, and we thought about doing this, and holy crap, man. Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons together put together such a deep, 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 deep book.
Is it deep?
Man, it's so deep you can't even see the bottom sometimes. That you get to the point where it's like, holy crap, how could two guys sitting around in the time period that they're doing, Matthew and I could probably come up with something similar to this, but never as deep as what this is. But this goes so, I mean, to sit there and go, well, what if we do this chapter called Fearful Symmetry or whatever the chapter is? And what if in the layout we mirror the panel layout design? Holy crap, I would never think about that in a million years.
Well, maybe you would.
Well, in a million years, maybe, but in the 6 months or so that they were leading up to the first issue, when they were putting everything together, would never have thought of that.
I mean, it's
there's a lot of subtext.
It's a couple of things. It's knowing your characters and knowing the story that you want to tell.
Right, right.
Once you know that, you can say, okay, how can we take this to the next level? Well, let's make the world mirror the characters. And so the world around Rorschach is horrendously gritty. You know, Dr. Manhattan builds a crazy palace in Mars, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then let's take it one step further. Let's have, you know, stuff that doesn't exactly pertain to the characters when they're around pertain to them. And then, you know, one step further, let's have the actual paneling reflect the mindset of the characters.
Yeah.
The text boxes, the stuff like the narration, all that stuff. Is another tool to continue to tell your story.
I think the reason why it blows me away so much is, and again, people can jump on this however they want, but you don't expect that from a comic book.
Sure.
Right? You don't
expect
it.
They certainly didn't back then, which is why, you know,
right,
it points everybody in the face so hard.
Yeah, so you don't expect it. So when it does happen, you're like, holy crap, right?
Part of the reason you don't expect it is the limitation of the medium. I mean, it's a monthly book. You don't have the time to put that kind of depth in a monthly book and still put it out monthly.
Right, I think that's what surprises me and impresses me a lot.
But on another level, it's a little harder to tell in the collected edition. And again, this is my standard issue argument. I read the individual issues.
Right.
And the first thing I noticed when I read issue 9 was that the cover is the first page of the story.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The cover is the first panel, and the cover always transitions you right into the book.
Yes.
At this point in time in comics, that type of artistry in terms of trade dress or in terms of the overall, what do you want to call it, je ne sais pouf of it all is, you know, it was startling to me, you know, from having read, you know, Sergeant Rock and X-Men and Avengers, which is what I got mostly at S&S Drugs. But the story itself has depths to where when you read it that first time, you're like, oh, that was interesting. It was like kind of a murder mystery and it had some little things. And then you read it the second time and you find more stuff. And you read it the third time and you find more stuff.
Yeah.
I think I've been reading the book off and on for, 25 years now?
Well, and this
now?
Is the thing. I've got a copy too, my first trade copy, that I still thumb through. When we got to the piece that I did on the shot-by-shot comparison with the trailer, I actually went out and bought another copy so I could deconstruct the comic, so I could it would lay on my scanner correctly.
Mm.
Then I went out and I've got the Absolute Edition because it's something that, you know, in the much larger format, it actually looks more. It looks prettier.
Cinematic.
It's cinematic, yes.
Cinematical. And it's a story that isn't, and I don't want to say a comic book story. It isn't an adventure story. It isn't a hero story. It isn't.
It's a journey.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly you could follow this from what Joseph Campbell would say, the story of the hero.
I love his soup, by the
way. Yeah. Mm.
But I think the way you have to look at it, at least from my perspective, is if you look at Watchmen and you don't like it, there's nothing wrong with not liking it. You don't have to like the Beatles. You don't have to love the Rolling Stones because they're popular. But if you look at Watchmen and you take it apart, there's something in there for everybody.
Yes.
To me.
Yes.
Even if you're, you know, like the geek me who wants to know more about the background and wants to read Hollis's book and wants to find out, you know, what may have happened here, here, and here, and what happened, you know, 500 years ago when Dollar Bill was shot, you know, these are things that appeal to me. When we get to the end, and can we spoiler it?
Well, the thing's been out for over 20 years, Matthew. If you haven't picked it up
I'm just saying, I get yelled at for spoiling things. When the giant squid shows up.
What? You're now talking about Outer Limits, right?
No, I'm talking about at what, 14, 15 when this came out, I went, wow, hate the giant squid.
Mm-hmm.
The last act, and I think it's intentional, the last act takes what feels a little hackneyed and feels a little familiar and feels a little comic booky and throws it in there and just goes, dun-da-da, giant squid, dun-da-da.
Yeah, but if you follow along, that's the whole thing. It's been leading up. If you're reading between what Blake was doing, crying at Mullocks, and you go and you see what the people on the island are doing, and then suddenly you've been getting all these swerves, so you're not expecting it to be Ozzie Davis. And then suddenly he talks about Evening Shade and pushes the button, and it's a big,
big octopus. Giant squid. Yeah. That moment, it both strengthens and weakens the overall narrative, because what it does is it really takes something, and one of the only elements of the plot that feels like a comic book or adventure or serial, you know, kind of thing, the Republic serial villain moment, and it puts it in this realistic, this real world perspective, and it makes it so, I don't know, it's a little bit of cognitive dissonance for me. But then you ask yourself, how would the nations of the world respond to something so incredibly alien and unthinkable?
We would unite.
To some degree, yeah. So when we take that,
at least the
okay,
so let's say the superpowers would unite. That's what the whole scare of the 80s were. Would Russia and the United States lay down their arms
each other
to combat a greater foe?
Possibly, if that greater foe came. Remember, it was Ronald Reagan who, you know, put together the Star Wars initiative, and those lasers weren't all pointing down. That's all I'm saying.
What he said. He said, there may come a threat someday where we may have to unite and use these weapons against some greater foe.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. The movie Meteor actually shows that, and my God, it's horrible. Sean Connery's got a terrible hairpiece.
Here's Hitman. When doesn't Sean Connery have a bad hairpiece? Maybe Red October.
Highlander.
Oh, shut up.
Hitman says, I handed Watchmen to my girlfriend who reads comics but never read Watchmen, and she loved it. I handed it to my dad, who hasn't read a comic book since Jerry Lewis number one when he was a kid, but enjoys the genre nonetheless, and he loved it. I handed it to my sister, who's fairly indifferent about what I'm into, and she loved it. I handed it to my mom, took a look at Nick and Dr. Manhattan, said no way. She did like the movie trailer, though. Watchmen is one of those works that goes beyond comics. It's literature. Not many comics can do that. On the flip side of that coin, we have Adam, who says, I honestly do not understand why people love this book. I know I'm in the super minority, but I hated this book. Hated it! And I completely understand all the themes and points of the story that's trying to make. I still hate it. It's full of sound and fury and ultimately signifies that all but one of the characters is a complete jackass.
I want to know who he's talking about.
All but one of the characters is a complete jackass. He's talking about Rorschach not being the jackass, I think.
I think as well. And if you look at it, you know, again, not putting any type of permutations or thought processes on somebody else's words. If you look at it as Rorschach is the hero, this is a terrible book.
Yeah, the hero dies.
It is.
And fails.
Absolutely a terrible book, because he gets blowed up at the end.
Real
and he goes through this whole, you know, he goes through this whole journey to heroism and gets blowed up. So if, as we suspect, Rorschach is his gateway character, then yeah, I would agree. This is a terrible story from that perspective. And that's another thing. You know, you don't have to love Watchmen. There is nothing that states that if you don't like Watchmen, you're not a comic fan, because
believe me, there are a lot of people who don't like great things. Matthew hates Kingdom Come. Matthew hates The Dark Knight Returns. Matthew's not a loser.
Matthew doesn't hate The Dark Knight
Returns.
Oh, I
thought you said you
hated
it.
Matthew hates Frank Miller.
Oh, okay.
There's a difference.
Yeah, there is a difference.
No,
you're right.
Kingdom Come is not great art. Kingdom Come is fan fiction. Now, going back to what it was we were talking about before I was so rudely interrupted. Or as
I
like to call it, the podcast.
What?
Shut up. It depends on who you are following through this book. The first time I read this book, the character I most empathized with was Laurie.
Mm-hmm.
The second time I read through this book, I realized that it's John who drives most of this, and I think intentionally so. But, you know, there's a time when I went through it and I looked at it and I was like, God, I feel bad for Blake to have gone through all of that stuff, to be that person in that reality, and then to have it all just blow up in your face and somebody throw you out a window because you're a relic.
If you
go through this story and look at it from an omniscient narrative perspective. If you look at it from, okay, I'm not rooting for Rorschach. I'm not rooting for Blake. I'm not wanting Dan to get the girl. I'm not wanting Lori to come back and put on that costume because hubba hubba zoot zoot, you know.
And there's boobies together, too. And a wiener.
Yeah. Thanks
and
for sharing.
And a wiener.
A big blue one.
when you go through the story, if you understand the points and you don't like it, that's absolutely valid criticism. And you can hate anything you want. And if I like it and you don't, that means that we have something to talk about.
Exactly.
But when it comes down to it, this story has its flaws. And, you know, one of them is a giant squid. But it's a story that works for me. And it's a story that drives people to talk and think and say things about comics that aren't often said about, you know, I don't know, X Factor number 39 or, you know, whatever it is that Rob Liefeld put out last week with Obama on the cover.
Youngblood.
Yeah, there you go. These are books that they may get something, but 20 years from now, what are we going to be talking about?
Watchmen.
Final Crisis. Not going to be Dark Reign.
Oh.
Probably not going to be Final Crisis.
The Sea Crane
Company?
We're going
to be talking about... Shut up. We're going to be talking about things that have resonance for the characters, that have resonance as a story, as an archetypical story. And as much as we throw that word around, this is several different types of archetypical stories thrown together. So, you know, you love it, you hate it. It changed comics forever. And I can say that because I was there.
Me too.
Man.
Young guys. Me too. You were not.
I was there in 86. I just didn't read it at the time.
You came in later.
Look at the time. Look at the time. Here, we got to wrap this thing up. So a final question. Obviously, the movie comes out this week, depending, again, when you listen to it. The question is, and I think Zack Snyder has even said, don't read the trade paperback before you see the movie. Of course, we've already done that. Yeah, I wish you would have told us that 20 years ago.
Yeah,
go. Okay, so here's
20 years ago, he was a 9-year-old.
I think we all agree that this is a thumbs up book, right? So the question is, for people who have not read Watchmen, all two of you out there, should you read Watchmen before you see the movie or wait until after you see the movie?
I would say wait. If you haven't seen it yet, you might as well just go see the movie.
And then read the book.
And then read the book.
Okay, Matthew?
I have never read a Harry Potter book until the movie has come out.
Really? Oh, yeah.
Because
okay.
I go and I see the movie and I go, oh, this was good. And then I read the book and it's like more backstory. Yeah. It's like the novelization of something that I saw in film with more depth and more perspective. I would say wait if you haven't read it already. If you have read it, don't reread it anytime soon so that you can go back after you've seen the movie.
That happened to me with Raiders of the Lost Ark. I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark, the movie, loved it to death. And then at a flea market or something, a year or two later, found the novelization of Raiders of the Lost Ark, read it, and I was like, holy crap, did you see this scene that wasn't in the movie? And look how it explains this and this and this. Wow, this is much better this way. Had I read the novelization first...
You would have been whining about where that scene went.
Where was that scene? Why isn't the squid in the movie? Well, if you've never read Watchmen... You're going to be surprised when you finally go back and read the book after you've seen the movie.
Unless you heard this podcast.
Well, in which case, you've probably already read the book.
The waiter says, what's wrong with the soup? And the man says, taste the soup. So, where's the spoon?
Let me ask you guys this. All right, Eddie Murphy. Aha! So I'm going to give you guys a choice here. Because you had mentioned Muppets early on.
You've already given me a Sophie's Choice tonight, so you can bite me.
I'm thinking about what we should cover next week, and it just popped into my mind. I don't know why. The Dark Crystal. You guys seen that movie?
Yes.
Matthew?
Was that the one with the Muppets that looked like Twiggy?
Yes.
Yeah, I've seen it.
All right. We can either talk about The Dark Crystal, the movie, for whatever reason, or we can talk about a brand new trade that's out this week, which would be a new review next week that we could all discuss. The New Brighton Archaeological Society.
Coming home with you. It's the New Zoo Review.
Which one would you guys want to do?
Oh, I love the Dark Crystal.
New Brighton Archaeological Society, which we're still going to do at some point, or the Dark Crystal. One's a book, one's a movie.
I'm not participating in any polls this week, so I'll be in abstention.
I'm kind of torn. I kind of want to talk about Dark Crystal. I haven't seen that movie in forever.
Yeah, man.
And we haven't really done any big movie discussions before. So, Matthew?
Does that have Skeksis in it?
But today, the ritual has no comfort.
So, why don't we next week, Matthew, dig up a copy of The Dark Crystal at your local VHS store?
Oh, please. I have on demand. I'll go get
it. Okay. And let's talk about The Dark Crystal next week on the Major Spoilers Podcast, which means we are at the end of the show. Thanks so much for spending your last 2 hours with us. Don't forget to tell everyone about the show. Don't forget to visit our website if you haven't already, majorspoilers.com. Hit us up by friending us over at MySpace. We're right there under myspace.com/majorspoilers. We also have a Twitter account if you decide to follow us. And if you're one of those damn spammers, don't do that. Bad spammer.
Bad spam bot.
We appreciate...
You are a bad clown. You must make a balloon animal.
We appreciate all the good things that people say about us. And we are hoping that you're telling all your friends about the show. If you have any questions, comments, topic ideas, want to call our hotline number. Matthew, what is that hotline number?
785-727-1939.
You can call us up there and leave a message, just like our caller did this week. Or you can drop us...
And if you try and do your best impersonation of me, I'll do my best impersonation of you.
If you would like to just email us, all you have to do is email us at podcast@majorspoilers.com. We'll be back next week.
And every week until this senseless carnage ends.
Because we know that you love comics, and we love senseless carnage too, and we will talk to you next time.
Dead dog in alleyway this morning, tire tread across burst stomach, went to Wendy's for hamburger.
Fat the X-ray vision of a Superman. I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic bookstore guy knew, they kicked my butt out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Think about a better way. If I was hulking green or gray, I could just bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little meat would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I back and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. If I'm Stark Raven rich like a man of iron, I might not be surprised if I'm that I might actually have the heart cold to follow an entire storyline. But would I really even need to read up on all those escapades? I mean, who needs such distractions when your sister's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast. Being shot up in a fun me in the Middle East with a gang sign throwing soldier. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. Whoa, 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 whoa. What a major spoiler.
I've started tying pants around my head when I go to sleep.
Why?
I got a CPAP machine.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the CPAP machine covers my whole head, and yeah. I'm getting this irritation at the back of my neck. So I've discovered that if I have...
It's always the most interesting part of the story, yeah. That he just shits
opens,
out.
Yep, he just opens a website right when he's about to get to the punchline.
I have a... Homie.
Oh boy. My little pony. My little pony.
Yo,
little pony. Baby, my little pony. Strawberry shortcake. Strawberry shortcake. Strawberry shortcake. My little pony.